Welcome to the CEN Show, the voice of the world community. In addition to our two podcast gatherings, Conscious Corner with host Professor Amin Ra and historian Joe Hembrick, and this show, we have a website, communityeducationnetwork.com. I want to encourage people to sign up for the forum so we can dialogue about topics that's on people's mind. So let me show everybody the website. Okay, here's the website. And you go to the form and you can sign up right here. All you need is an email address. And you can sign up, and then you can go ahead and post some anything that you're interested in, and any opinions you have, and people will respond, and we can dialogue. So I want to encourage everybody to do that. Let me introduce myself. I am your host, Rasaki Mascani, and I also want to introduce the panel. We have Professor Amin Ra. He's one of our team members, and he's the host of Conscious Corner. We have Damian McCallman. He is responsible for our guests being here this evening, and I'm glad that he got our guests this evening. We also have Brother Mashinda. He's in Louisiana. We grew up together. He's a little older than me, and he taught me a lot of things. You know, running in the streets, playing ball. He went to college. He was a person that I could look up to and emulate. And so he's one of our team members, but he's not officially on the website. Hopefully one day he'll say, go ahead and put him on there. So that's Brother Mashinda's here. Tonight's guest. Okay, he want to say something. Go ahead, Brother Mashinda. What did you say?
It was me. I said sometimes. Oh, go ahead. Sometimes you have to draft people in the struggle. You know that. When was at Cal State Long Beach, we claimed all black people in the BSU.
Okay.
Some active, some not, but that inflated our numbers. You know.
Okay, so. All right. Well, he's a part of it. Yeah. He's here enough to be, and I appreciate it. All right. Thanks, Professor Ron. Yeah. All right. Tonight's guest is Kalisha Beard. She's a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm going to interview her this evening. I was introduced to her, like I was saying earlier, by our previous guest, Damian McCallman, which he's here this evening supporting us and supporting her, which is excellent. And I just found out that Miss Beard used to work at our school. She was there for a few years. And I also found out that the school I used to teach at, she was right next door, and she graduated from the school right next door. So this is really a small world. All right, so that was cool to learn that. Okay, good evening, Ms. Beard. How are you, and can you tell us some things about yourself?
Good evening, and thank you all for having me on your show. I've done a little research and, you know, gotten familiar with some of the episodes, and I think you guys are doing great work. So thank you for having me, and thank you, Damian, for telling me about this. A little bit about myself. I was born in Bellflower. Actually, I'm sorry. I was born in Long Beach, lived in Bellflower and Norwalk. And I pretty much say I'm from Long Beach. So local, did a lot of education in Compton. And then I switched to public school in Long Beach. So I'm very familiar with the area. I work in Los Angeles in the, I would say, Watts area, right around Martin Luther King Hospital, and just doing some good work in the community. I love working with children and their parents. So doing a lot of work parenting with children and their parents, and I work as a therapist. So I'm married. I have three dogs, children on the way soon within the next 2 years, continuing education right now at USC for a doctoral program. So I love learning. I could be the type of person who's in school forever if it weren't so expensive. And that's just me in a nutshell. I like to laugh. I like to joke. I love baking. So I'll be baking chocolate chip cookies after this and just having a good night.
That's excellent. I'm glad that you're here. And also, I like oatmeal cookies
Nice.
with no raisins, but that's the kind out
Yes.
there.
Yes, I don't like the raisins either, but a good oatmeal cookie without them is good.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so let's get started with some questions here. Okay, last week, Professor Amirat posed a question to us, and he went around the panel and asked everybody this. He said, "What can Black people do to make their relationships better with each other?"
Yeah, and that's a really good question. I think we first have to begin with recognizing our collective trauma history. So, going back to slavery and thinking about all of the trauma that was endured during that time, and the trauma that's been recent for many Black people. I mean, before 2020, but it really worsened during that time. And just thinking about what we as a people are going through collectively, and hopefully that heightens our empathy for one another. I think that we're all Black people are in the struggle, and it's happening at different ends of a spectrum or a continuum, but it's definitely happening. And I think we have to acknowledge that. We also have to decide to support each other. And it's tricky because when people do not have their basic needs met, a lot of times there's increased strife and bickering between each other, even if they are of the same ethnicity and ethnic background. But as much as we can to try to really notice that we are sisters, that we are brothers, that we have had shared collective trauma, and that we can and are capable of making a decision to support one another. I think that's what the next step has to be. We also have to educate ourselves on relationships and trauma and the role that it plays in our relationships. So, I mean, I can try to relate to the best of my ability to someone who, is of the same race or of a different race. But if I don't acknowledge trauma and the role that it plays on shaping behavior, especially for somebody who is not in therapy, the role that trauma, I mean, it could change you. Somebody could have been a totally happy person, love to get along with other Black people, and then undergo some significant trauma and their personality totally changed. So we have to educate ourselves on relationships and trauma. And then we also have to, and this is what I really want to emphasize here, we have to do personal development and work on ourselves. We have to, at some point in life, and I'm a mental health advocate. So I'm somebody that's going to tell you that everybody needs therapy, that their mom needs therapy, that their grandma needs therapy, and great grandma too, if she's still alive. So we have to do personal development, and we have to go to mental health therapy at some point in our lives. Some of us need to be in therapy for decades to peel back whatever trauma we've experienced. And it could be due to racism, it could be due to systemic oppression, it could be due to all kinds of trauma. There's many different forms, and I'm sure we'll get into that at some point. But we have to educate ourselves, and we have to do personal development, go to therapy at some point, because therapy is necessary to make any relationship better. So if I'm going to understand you best in your struggle and understand conflict and why there is conflict between people of the same race and those sorts of things, I have to have at some point come into contact with some sort of insight-oriented mechanism to help me grow and evolve as a person. And I think a lot of, I mean, we're still trying to work to reduce stigma around going to therapy and those kinds of things. A lot of people are not educated. They have no insight into how the way they think shapes the way that they feel and shapes the way that they behave. So when it's time to relate and show up in any relationship, it could be a marriage, it could be, you know, with someone of the same race, opposite race, they struggle because there's been no work done on self. So I think that's a huge one. We have to, and I'll kind of summarize. So recognize the collective trauma history that we all share. We have to decide to support one another. We have to educate ourselves on relationships and trauma. And we have to commit to personal development and mental health therapy at some point if we're going to try to relate better, because there's definitely a lot of dissension. And here's the thing that therapy will do. I think any insight-oriented therapist, if let's just say the client is showing up and they have enough insight to say, like, I don't get along well with Black people. As the therapist works and tries to help that person uncover why that might be, I mean, so much will be revealed. So why do I feel the need to create a hierarchy between myself and someone of the same race? Why do I have the need to create this hierarchy? Maybe there's some deep-rooted insecurities. Maybe there's some deep-rooted vulnerabilities, some deficits, some voids that exist that were never filled. And we need to go deep into those places to try to get them healed. So what have I been kind of using as a band-aid to cover up things that were never met or filled in my life? Why do some And it's funny because I never even realized that this existed, but it does. Colorism. Why is colorism a thing? Why is it that people who are light-skinned treat people who have darker skin complexions different? And we know that it's rooted in slavery, but I think a good therapist would go to that place. Why do you discriminate with people who have deeper skin complexions? What are your implicit biases? And I think that we don't get to show up in relationships better until we undergo some sort of process that reveals to us that we all have biases and that we're operating and functioning or functioning impaired, extremely impaired, but we're trying to function from those deficit places. And they have to be looked at and targeted. I didn't know colorism existed, oddly, until I was dating someone and they said, "Wow, you know, I was nervous about talking to you because you're light-skinned and you know what they say about light-skinned people." And I was like, "No, fill me in. What do they say?" And he says, "They say that you guys are stuck up, like you guys think you're better than other people." And all of this, I had no awareness of. I came from a background where, I mean, as far as I can recall, people were treated equal. You didn't get extra favors or brownie points because you were light skinned. Everybody was equal. Everybody had to study. Everybody had to read. There was no favoritism. My sister and I, we have different skin complexions, no differences in parenting between the two of us. I mean, what was emphasized in my background was character. It doesn't matter how beautiful you are, like who are you internally? That was always emphasized over external beauty. So that was where I was coming from. And I had no idea that it existed until different people, I started hearing the same message. Oh, when I first met you, I thought you would be stuck up, but you're not. Like, oh, wow, I was so surprised that you aren't stuck up. I remember my first job from. My first job that I got after graduating from my master's program, the program director said, like, wow, I was really shocked to see that you came here and like you keep your door open. I thought you would just kind of come and just be away from everybody and not really relate, but you actually have really great relationships with other people who work here. Everybody likes you. And Once again, there's all I could attribute it to is there's a difference in complexion here. And this is what is said to be about people who are light skinned. And I'm having no idea that this is what is said, but we have to start to unpeel some of those things. And after I became aware of that, I started to notice that there are people who treat other people different because of that. And it should not be. So I think doing our own personal work and kind of evaluating, like, how do we present in certain situations? How do people perceive us? Why is that there? Is it mostly a them problem? Is it a me problem? Am I putting out superiority? Let me take a look at that. Let me dive deeper into that. Let me do additional work and conversations to show up more authentically and to let other people know that I can relate to them and relate to them well, that there's no, preconceived hierarchy or superiority, false sense of like I'm better than you being communicated here. And I think that only comes from having done reflective, and I'm talking about deep, intensive, reflective work. Like you can't get out of it, and relationships will not get better until it's done.
Wow. You know what? I've been saying this, that because we live in a color context world, it causes so much confusion, and then these biases, and then they then you know the light skin, dark skin, it's wild. But this system that we live in causes all of this confusion, and it's a mess. But I want to extend this a little bit, this question. Okay, what can you say about people that don't go to therapy? And from what you were saying, you're saying that they should. Is there any way that people can get therapy without going to a professional? As far as, having strategies, because I teach strategies on how to deal and cope and all of that. Would you ever recommend that somebody do it on their own? Well, I don't think you would, but I'm saying that people can, develop strategies that can be therapeutic, in my opinion. But
I
what would you
believe
say to
that.
that?
I would say that people for sure can, over the course of their life, develop strategies that do serve as therapeutic for them. And you do have a lot of people who are highly intuitive and just self-reflective by nature. So I don't want to discount that. I think that you can do a lot of good, strong work independent of a licensed practitioner. However, all people have blind spots, and that's something that we can't ignore. So I think at a certain point, people can plateau. I'm talking about people who read for hours, who just have tons of time to listen to lectures and podcasts and audiobooks and YouTube. And oh, I don't watch TV at all because I'm always educating myself. And I mean, even somebody who is maybe at that end of the continuum, who's doing a lot of deep introspective work, is still going to have blind spots as it relates to how they show up in the context with other people. And so, getting that feedback from other people and presenting it to somebody who's unbiased, there may be certain things that somebody from the outside starts to pick up, like, have you considered this? Have you considered that? And I'm speaking from experience. I believe everybody should have therapy, therapist included. So, I've done a lot of therapy myself. I'm not somebody who's like, I've arrived in my 30s, like, and I have all things on life figured out. No. The process is an ongoing journey. And so therapists need therapy. Pastors need therapy. And I'm trying to think of everybody who's kind of sought out for advice here. Presidents, presidential candidates, pretty much any high position, CEOs, executives, CFOs, everybody needs it. Everybody needs it.
All right, that's good, good. So what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna break from the questions because I want to get the panel involved. So I'm gonna go, welcome, Sister Linda. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. And yourself?
Okay, so do you have a question or comment for Ms. Beard here?
I don't know. I don't necessarily have it because I'm just listening and it's very interesting. So I have no question at this time. So
Okay,
you go.
I'll come back to you.
Thank you.
All right, Brother Damien.
Yes, I think I thought you were going to go to, because we talked about it when you came to the school. Like, can we seek? I think I asked you the question of can any one of us be a therapist, and give advice? Because I think a lot of us do that. We'll go to, like you said, a trusted friend or someone who we deem as responsible. Is that good enough? Or, should we seek that person who has some background educationally? Or can we just stick with going to my buddy who I've known for 20 years, who's never sort of led me astray?
Yeah, and I want to validate that. I think the professional clinical world doesn't validate that often enough, that there are spaces where some really good work is happening. I mean, I grew up in a religious family, born and raised Christian, still identify as Christian to this day, and there were so many great people in that context who helped me out. And I would say it was definitely therapeutic. They didn't go to school for it or anything like that. But in terms of their skill set and their ability to influence, persuade, and impact, they were successful. And I believe that that is why I am where I am to this day. At the same time, I had that experience going to therapy as well myself. So I feel like I still advocate for both because both have been life-changing for me. So I was at USC and they basically said, like, you can't become a therapist if you're not willing to look at yourself first within the context of therapy, because you're essentially asking your clients to do something that you haven't yet done. I mean, that is like leadership hypocrisy 101, right? So you're asking them to sit in a chair, metaphorically, you've never sat in. So go work on your own stuff. And by the time you finish this program, you'll be in a better position to lead and to lead well. So I did it after years of training and leadership through church and in that sort of environment. And I will say that the experience going into the professional therapeutic world was, I would venture to say, just as powerful. And this is why I feel, and I would say my expertise is, actually, I'm venturing into a new expertise now in the doctoral program, but working with children who are being raised in religious families. And so I think one of the crucial points is that a lot of emphasis is placed on other things, but we have to emphasize spirituality. I'm kind of losing my train of thought. Sorry, it's been a very long day and I've been in this chair for most of the day. Let me kind of recap here. I would say that I had just as powerful of an experience in the therapeutic chair as I've had in the church. And oh, this is where I was going. Churches now are becoming more progressive and they're realizing that not everything can be done on a Sunday, not everything can be done in a Bible study, not everything can be done in prayer, but there are strategies that need to be practical and that need to be gained in therapeutic context. And so that was my experience. Like, God I'm a believer. He's changed my life. I don't get into that when I'm in therapeutic sessions and those sorts of things, but I definitely do believe, to your point, that great work can be done in other contexts, whatever those other contexts are for people. For me, it was church. But then going to USC, they say, go to therapy. I listened. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. That was life-changing as well. And I think that people should try, because pretty much every person that I've talked to that did get quote unquote therapy from other settings that then went as an adult into an actual trained clinician's office, pretty much everybody has been like, wow, this has been what has been missing for my whole life.
So I would look at that as being more holistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I wanted to go to Professor Rob. Professor Rob, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you get therapy?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it from professional or it's non-professional in the?
Well, it's from everywhere, you know. I interact with professionals, not for professional therapy, from standpoint of clinical help or consultation, but just reading life and learning the life lessons, seeing how other people cope with trauma, seeing how other people cope with frustration, loneliness, emptiness, and learn lessons from that. And then sometimes, you know, I talk to a lot of people. People come to me for advice and sometimes for, you know, education and just problem solving, you know, is very critical. And, you know, I was I did psychological counseling for under the license of Dr. George Demos, where he was a white psychologist, but he had black clients, but he always would call me in to deal with some of the black athletes. I did Lewis Brown. I did a couple of basketball players that was on our teams and things of that nature. So it's pretty, you know, what I get what Felicia is saying is different from the standpoint of having that balance of street and academic and activism and non-activism in the movement. So, you know, we just have to keep on struggling no matter what with ourselves and with any obstacles, social or spiritual or folk that we deal with, because people don't like to get follow directions. You give people directions, they think you're calling them stupid. And if they seek consultation, they think they're calling themselves stupid. So it's a very complex situation. But I understand what Kalisha's saying, that everybody needs therapy. I mean, Queen Mother Moore used to say we suffer from oppression psychoneurosis, a term that she created from as black people. Bobby Wright, Dr. Bobby Wright, as clinical psychologist, said that we suffer from being menticide. You know what I mean? Then you have, to me, as a black person, our therapy is different from a white person or Chinese or Latino, and being an African American. I mean, it's a complex situation. Once you know who you are, it don't make no difference where you are. But at the same time, it's a lot of complex things that are going. Those that stumble up on therapy, you know, you meet somebody and they help you solve your problems and teach you. You know, there are people that go through yoga to get their minds together. There's people that go through hypnosis. Me and Dr. Demos, that's what we used to do, hypnosis. And then there's people that deal with, as I said, yoga, hypnosis. Some deal with meditation as a form of therapy. Some people deal with drugs. That's where LSD came from. They help people see things that, life, not just to get high. So, it's a complex. But personally, do I seek a professional therapist? No. But I consider the world my therapeutic life, and reading and studying this program is therapy to me. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. What we do as far as discussing Black issues, I mean, I get off. You understand? You talk to me, that's it. You understand? And being in organizations, but I'm 74. You understand? Mm-hmm. So that's, like you tell the kids who say, I'm 25, you don't understand me. I said, no, I've been 25. You ain't never been 74. So I'm way ahead. You understand? And so, those are complex. But there's a lot of, and she is correct, there's a lot of mental problems out here, emotional problems, not psychotic, but people suffer from loneliness, people suffer from isolation, people in the midst of a big family, but they just rather be by themselves. You'd be surprised at the issues that humans have. But that's a part of the diversity of humans and the distinctiveness of humans, And you can make money by making this a problem, but it's a whole new different game out there. But I got a few questions I have for each, so
let's get her one question, and then I want to go to Brother Mashinda.
Well, you can go to Mashinda first.
I'll come back to you. All right, thanks, Professor Rock. Oh, Brother Mashinda.
Hello and good evening. I appreciate Sister Kalisha Beard coming on tonight to impart her knowledge, give us a presentation. Very interesting. I was sitting here listening, and I thought about my time working in institutions, criminal institutions, I guess you could say, with juveniles and adults, working in education on a daily basis. Years of experience dealing day in and day out dealing with people, young and middle aged and older people, and different personalities and different issues and problems. And throughout that experience, I developed my own skill sets, and my own way to maybe troubleshoot certain issues and problems with people. However, and so as I, matriculated through this life. And so basically, like I say, currently, I have somebody that's kind of way up. That's, I guess you can consider that's my boss, and they're a licensed counselor. They're LCS, and they have a lot of experience, and they're much younger than me. And so it comes with and it took me a while, because I'm always trying to be a thinker and trying to be objective. But we were told, like in the educational setting, we have to be careful what we tell our clientele, our students, our charges, or, whether, they're incarcerated or if they're a student in the classroom, when problems arise, it's like, hey, you're not a licensed counselor. Like refer them. You can kind of do some basic troubleshooting, but hey, tell them, in other words, I have to get them in touch with her or somebody else, one of the professionals that are licensed. And, I wouldn't say I took offense to that, but I was like, wait a minute, like Professor Ross say, like he said, he was, like the 25 and 74 example, you know, I got way more life experience than this person. You know, life experiences and job experiences and dealing with people on a day-to-day basis. It's like, wait, how can you tell me something? Well, and really, it didn't resort to that because I really, it wasn't argumentative, but it was in my mind. It was like, wait a minute. What do you mean I can't? I've been doing this all my professional life, you know, in terms of dealing with people and, you know, kind of, you know, off the cuff or, you know, not premeditated, just, you know, dealing with situations as they arise. Well, but I had to be a deeper thinker, and I got to thinking. I said, you know, yeah, I found out what I thought about. I said, in my situations, you know, I was dealing with a lot of different people at one time, different folks, but I was not in that position of all I did was talk to this individual, talk to individuals that this wasn't my primary job. I was doing crisis intervention and I think I learned to do a pretty good job at that. Hey, keep that person from killing themselves right then, you know, keep them from fighting right then, you know. So, and then everything calmed down. They were cool for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, you know. But did that take away their pain, their misery, their trauma, as you say, their trauma? And so I started thinking, I said, well, you know, these licensed therapists and folks, this is what they specialize in. They create a plan. They have methods and strategies to, you know, in their training to and develop their experience, you know, and to learn how, you know, what works, what might work, you know. You know, there's an attempt there to try to make change in this person's life. And so I didn't do that. I wasn't, you know, it's just my, you know, off the cuff experiences. And yeah, I calmed everybody down, or I got that person to see the light. But that trauma, you know, so what happens if it, you know, and again, I'm saying, what happens if that fire flames back up, you know, is and it's a great possibility. And it has things, you know, like in other words, I might have did something good for the day and that person was great, but they went home and 2 weeks later they killed themselves or something. Like, oh wow, you know. So had they had some intervention and some where it was on a controlled, you know, like, hey, you know, like listen to this plan and you know, this layout and what we're trying to accomplish. So I had a whole new respect for what, you know, for something that I thought like, oh man, I've been doing this the whole time, but I haven't been. It's you know, I haven't been laying out. I was just a troubleshooter on the spot. So I was helpful in the equation. Don't get me wrong. I was instrumental, and not looking for any credit. It was just who I am and who I've been. But so anyway, I respect your work. I respect your conversation and where you headed with it. And you know, I think you're absolutely right in, you know, identifying trauma. And I think even like I say, even with myself, I think, you know, black males, you know, macho, you know, we can, you know, suck it up, you know, we're gonna be all right, you know, and all that. You hear all that. But you know, hey, but I try to, you know, day to day identify what's going on with me and try to stay ahead of it. But if I find myself going into a, you know, like a consistent mode where, you know, if I'm feeling a little depressed or something I can't shake, then I do seek, you know, I seek help. And that, you know, of course, it could be meditation. It could be, like I say, it could be whatever, you know, something that's gonna make me, you know, cope with whatever I'm doing. I guess the name of the game is how can I cope? How can I coexist with whatever has traumatized me or made me feel a certain way? How could I continue to progress in my life, you know, without, you know, all these headaches and stress and things like that? So exercising and things like that. So I think, you know, having coping mechanisms and stress relievers and things like that help me alleviate my, you know, things that might develop. But something that's deep-seated that I might have been affected by when I was younger, well, I mean, you know, I don't know. I haven't went that deep in terms of like, you know, but anyway, I like to think that I'm on track and I'm not, you know, too crazy or whatever. But anyway, thank you for coming on. You know, I could talk all day, but you're very interesting and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Brother Mashinda. That's really a powerful story.
Okay, I'm gonna go back to a question here, and then I'll go to the panel again. So let me ask you this question. In Psychology Today, you stated your approach when treating clients is eclectic. Can you give a brief overview of this approach?
Yes. So I would say that it always starts with person-centered therapy. So beginning with where the client is, where the family is. I try to do a lot of family work because I do specialize in working with children and adolescents. So most people that know that you're incredibly limited when working with children, if you just work with them, because they're going back to a family system. So I really like engaging the parents and starting with where they are. So where is this family system? Where is the client who's been identified as the person that has whatever the issue is? And in terms of the eclectic approach, it means, you know, being trained in different therapeutic modalities and kind of fusing them together, if you will. So having a psychoanalytic bent and a desire to help people improve insight and look at, you know, the past and maybe how it's shaping the present, but then also still doing a lot of present-centered and present-focused work, relying a lot on behavioral interventions and cognitive behavioral therapy modalities that are evidence-based for treating depression, anxiety, those kinds of things. So really spending a lot of time in helping the person to look at how they're thinking and how that thinking shapes the way that they feel and how they behave and show up in whatever their relationships are. So cognitive behavioral therapy would be an approach that I lean on. I wouldn't say heavily, but it's used a lot. And then insight-oriented, psychoanalytic. And then more increasingly, people are seeking me out because I do have a spiritual background. So people who are interested in trying to figure out how to merge their faith, whatever their background is, with these, you know, structured principles. So with the practical, so how do we take spirituality and apply it to our life in a practical sense? So looking at that as well.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Miss Linda, any question yet or comment?
No, I'm still soaking it in. I have no questions at this time.
Okay. Brother Damien.
So I think, so if you were talking to, like you said, church folks who probably forever, as long as we've known, have just simply relied on, as you was talking, you know, just relied on prayer and faith. You can come up with, I'm pretty sure you probably come up with Bible verses that says, that's not all it says, right? So how do you do the two? Like if I say, okay, well, I'm dealing with something depressed, I'm just going to pray about it. I'm just going to believe my faith. What do you say to that person?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really goes back to if we're thinking of a therapeutic modality, it would probably be cognitive behavioral therapy because there's a maladaptive cognition there that's not serving the person well. And it has to do with how they're misconstruing scripture. And one of the things that I've realized, because I am also a minister too, and that doesn't mean in any shape or form that I've evolved. I haven't gone to theological school or seminary or anything like that, but I have done some trainings year long and graduated that kind of thing from pastors and been under the tutelage of well-respected leaders in that setting. So one of the things that I've learned in schools and ministries that I've been a part of is that a lot of people take scriptures and they don't understand them. They have not done any work into the background, into the context, into how to properly exegete scripture. They probably don't know what a concordance is. They probably don't know what a biblical study Bible is, and really trying to delve into how this scripture was written. How does it apply in this day and age? So there's so much work to be done just with that. Like, we understand scripture, but we're bringing our lens to the text. And a lot of times it convolutes things. And I mean, if we talk about scripture, we definitely would be looking at faith without works is dead. And so, you know, I could have faith and I could be praying for healing from depression and all those kinds of things. But could it be that God is asking me to take practical steps? And there's people who sit on their couch and pray all day for God to do whatever it is that they're asking, but they're not taking practical measures, you know, and there's so many different schools of thought on this, but we get into, like, did God not create the doctors who are prescribing whatever? Did God not create and make the therapist? And really trying to go to certain scriptures that they feel they understand and present them in a new way. And, you know, I have to acknowledge privilege. Some of the other questions talk about, you know, racism. And I think that privilege should always be acknowledged. White privilege, white people should acknowledge their privilege. I have to acknowledge my privilege. I've done some studying here. So what it means is that I do have, you know, a greater ability to persuade and influence when I'm working with clients who come from this background, and they are more trusting. They've heard me speak in those settings and, like, okay, wow, this is somebody we feel we can trust. And now when I talk to them from the professional side of things, the clinical side of things, it's like, okay, that makes a little bit more sense. But it's because of the privilege that's, you know, they've heard me speak in other contexts and heard people who have influence and power introduce me. And so they're more willing to actually listen.
Okay. All right, Damien, did that answer your question? All right. All right, Professor Rock.
Thanks. Beautiful presentation, but you know, you made a lot of comments. Do you think, from a therapeutic standpoint, that there is a issue between colorism, as you call it, that affects us as a people? And I ask you that question out of the context that do you feel that that's because of the racism in this society, where they treat lighter people better and give them more opportunities? Or are these people just having illusions that you're getting treated better, if you like? Is there a history of that from your standpoint, from a therapy? I mean, how would you approach a person that may be having a sense of trauma because they feel that they're too dark? Mm-hmm. And then another person having trauma thinking that I want to have a light person, but so that when I have kids, they have pretty skin and long hair that mm-hmm. we used to go through in school. So how do you deal with mm-hmm. that?
Yeah. I definitely think that colorism exists because of the overarching theme of racism. So if we go back to slavery times, there was people who were enslaved, African-Americans, Black people who were enslaved, and because they remained powerless to white people and their slave masters, within the Black race, they, you know, inadvertently had to create some system of hierarchy amongst themselves to try to gain some sort of power. So then you start seeing people who are preferred. And of course, the rapes and everything that were happening with the white slave masters. And then you have people being born with lighter tones and those kinds of things, working in the house, not having to work in the slave fields and the plantations, picking cotton and those kinds of things, being more preferred, there becomes this, you know, this hatred for people who are treated differently. And it definitely is rooted in racism overall. And so I think that once again, everybody who has a position of privilege, and everybody does to some degree, but everybody who has a position of privilege has to acknowledge that. So I can honestly say, I don't feel I've ever been preferred more over someone who maybe has a darker skin tone, but I can't prove that. And based on what I just said, it probably has happened. It probably just isn't in my awareness. So I, as a person who has lighter skin, has to acknowledge that I am privileged because of racism and because of what's gone on in our society. I was just born with this skin tone and I have the privilege. I have to acknowledge that. And then I also have to acknowledge the pain that other people face who have deeper skin complexions. I'm listening to this amazing audiobook, Viola Davis's memoir, where she talks about what it was like to grow up in her hometown, where she experienced bullying and ridicule. And I'm not talking about bullying like many children talk about today, and that's not to minimize what children are saying about bullying, but I mean the extreme forms of bullying, where you're going home with bloody nose, where it got physical. It wasn't online. And of course, cyberbullying is real. I'm not trying to minimize any of those things, but a heightened sense of, you know, physical brutality because of skin tone, something that nobody chose. We didn't go to a factory and say, yeah, God, have me be born with this tone. And I think those kinds of conversations have to be had. I think people with lighter complexions have to acknowledge the pain of people who have been discriminated against because they've had deeper complexion. That privilege has to be discussed. People have to be validated. And I think that we eventually have to just help people be able to heal. So Viola Davis talks about in her book how she went to therapy and how she began to start processing some of these childhood traumatic experiences.
But the experience outside the family's work, when coming up, when she was coming up, lynching and police shootings, things of this nature, is way worse than somebody just saying, you're a black wench, or you some calling you names. But let me get to this other part, because we have a saying, you know, a lot of doctors need a doctor. You understand? Mm-hmm. Because they abuse they need therapy themselves, and they need treatment themselves. You can look at the gynecologists at SC and UCLA, that you know, the people go there to get a physical, and they all up in them, you know. So, you know, you have that, but I'm just, and they have a doctor. I mean, they have medical doctors, you know.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But getting back
major to major abuses of authority, and I was there during the time of that doctor at SC. Yeah.
Do you think that Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, you know, your major religions with heavy populations, in comparison to Christianity, could people get the same spiritual therapy from those groups that they get from scriptures? Because, you know, the question of the Bible, men wrote the Bible. You got to agree with it. Not saying Christ. They say they were given the message from God. They scripted. And the Jewish scholars wrote it. There's no references or footnotes in Bible. This is just God's word. The word Bible means collection of books. Holy Bible means they're spiritual books inspired by God. So that's the difference between the word Bible. That's why on the Bible it says Holy Bible. It means holy book. Okay, now, my issue is, you know, spirituality is very important. But you have a lot of people may believe in spiritual power, but not a deity, not a God. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, it's about practice, not prayer. You know, you got to put, you know, you can't just mm-hmm. pray your way out of it. You got to put it into practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you deal with the diversity of the world
mm-hmm.
and try to find a monolithic way of dealing with therapy? You know, trying to find mm-hmm. a common denominator with all these messages out there.
Yes. I think therapists have to be researchers, and that's why therapy is no space for proselytizing, for trying to, you know, convert someone. If the therapist does have a religious orientation or affiliation, that's not the space for it, because that violates, you're basically trying to go somewhere where the client is not, and that violates the therapeutic frame. So in terms of dealing with diversity in the therapeutic context, the therapist has to be curious and they have to be a researcher. So if they're not familiar with the other religions that their clients are coming from and that are a part of, they then have to educate themselves and consult always. So for instance, I didn't grow up Mormon, but I have clients who are Mormon. I have people that I work with as colleagues who are Mormon. So when I get a Mormon client, I will do my own research. But then in addition to that, I consult with somebody in real time who has that background. Now, ultimately, if a therapist or a clinician is getting someone who's totally outside of their depth, and that could be with regards to diagnosis. It, for instance, I don't specialize in treating eating disorders. So, you know, if I feel like a client is coming and they're presenting with different things that are outside of my depth, outside of my realm of expertise, then ultimately I'm going to want to refer them to a more appropriate treatment provider. But I think in regards to like religious diversity, the therapist has to educate themselves. They have to look into it. And it goes back to where is the client, because another thing that happens a lot is people will say they're from certain orientations and those kinds of backgrounds, but they're not really practicing at the time. So, you know, would that even be brought up in their therapy sessions at all? Like, it kind of just depends on where the person is and what they're coming with and what they want to get out of it. Some families, they may say that they were Catholic, but once again, maybe not really practicing much. So if they don't really want to delve into that, if they don't feel like their family was really ingrained in that way of thinking in life, and if they don't feel like it really shaped what they're coming to therapy for, and if it doesn't shape like their frame of mind and in terms of like the problems that they're dealing with and that kind of thing, it may not even be brought up. It's at that point we have to argue, is it relevant, is it not? And if it's relevant, then I as a therapist need to educate myself on how to best support the person that's in front of me.
Well, I'm just my last point. And Asante for that answer. Asante means thank you. In Swahili, but
thank you.
some of the biggest advocates of Black resistance to white oppression built some of the strongest movements were brothers and sisters with a light pigmentation. Farrakhan, Adam Clayton Powell, Stokely mm-hmm. Carmichael, Thurgood Marshall, Malcolm X, Dr. Karanga, all of these were light brothers, but they fought. They saw themselves as Black people,
mm-hmm.
and you know they dealt with it from that standpoint. So there are a lot of people that exploit their privilege of mm-hmm. Then there's others that, hey, you know, I know that they at one time, if you have an inkling, a third degree of white blood in you, they considered you black.
Yeah.
At one time. I know there's many people, Native Americans and Italians and all of them have black genes in them. You see what I mean? From Hannibal, all of that. At the same time, the struggle of racism in Africa, you can change your race. You know, in South Africa at one time, apartheid. If you know, if you would like, you can say, well, you know, I want to be Asian. And, you know, you can change your racial classification. In this society, you can't. You understand that you know, I don't care how light you're not. Now they're trying to say you can, you don't have to put down no race color, or you can say other, you know, and things of this nature. They're trying to divide, but they don't treat you that way. You know, I mean, Trayvon Martin was light. So the dynamics of therapy in a racist society, and when most of the trauma that black people get in this country is because of racism. Mm-hmm. You understand? And the history of the Holocaust of enslavement. Let me give you an example. Kamala Harris, is that her name? The vice president. Her husband got on and talked about, he's Jewish. And they had a meeting with the president. Jewish leaders and Jewish people to talk about the anti-Semitism. Kamala, to this day, has not called a meeting of black people with the president to talk about racism. They had a meeting to talk about voting rights and voting and discrimination. Of royal oppression, but they never sat and said, let's have this discussion about racism. So how do you, as a therapist, deal with the complexities of solving a therapeutic problem such as anxiety, frustration, depression? Mm-hmm. And the person still got to go out there and face racism.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Yeah. That. So going back to working with children, the way I kind of frame it is you're in a game, and you know, through activism and advocacy and those kinds of measures and looking at policy changes and lobbying and those kinds of things, we're trying to change the rules of the game, but the rules of the game have not yet been changed. So as a child of color, one of the biggest things is to recognize what cards you have in your hand and to try to play them as best as you can in a system of oppression. So to try to make really good choices, to do the best that you can. And much of sessions with people of color who are coming to sessions because of, you know, problems that are directly related to racism, a lot of times it's a lot of the work is validation. So I see you, and people seek me out again because I am a person of color. So we want somebody who knows like what that struggle is like. We want somebody who identifies as black, who can help, you know, my child. Like, so parents come in specifically because they want that. Maybe the child is going to a you know, a prestigious, rigorous school that is predominantly, you know, maybe white or other races are present on the campus, and they're the minority. And so a lot of time is spent validating what that must feel like. You know, how is it for you to go to a campus where you're the minority, where you're maybe bussed in because you live in quote unquote the hood and your parent doesn't want you to go to school in that neighborhood. So now your commute is 2 hours one way because you're going to this prestigious school and you're having to do homework on the bus all the way back to get to your house. Like, what is that like? And all in hopes of you getting a better education. And once again, so validating like what that has to be like. I'm the person who has the curly hair, who has, you know, naps and texture to my hair. And I'm going to school with other people who can wear their hair long and flowy. So there's exchanges and, you know, self-disclosure to some degree where I may share as a therapist, if clinically appropriate and strategically, where I may share my experiences with some of these nuances and dynamics, like how that feels to go to school with people who have different hair than you and where they have different means, where their parents are buying them Mercedes and they have maids and they have nannies and their parents are buying them spare houses and you're going to school and you're getting bussed in. Like I've had clients in those situations where, I mean, I can't help but do anything but validate that that is real. But the whole therapy cannot just be spent in the context of validation. We also have to talk about how to move forward. And in moving forward, we have to recognize what is the state of affairs? What are the current dynamics? It is oppressive. It is oppressive. It is, there is racism, and I speak to those things, but how do you make the most of what's been put in your hand? So you want to go to that school, you want to travel, you want to commute. Let's talk about what are your goals, what are your aspirations? And ultimately, when you are self-actualized and you're the person who has become who you saw yourself becoming, how do you then try to, after being put in a position of influence and power, to make things better for the generation who's younger, who is going to be dealing with some of those dynamics? How do you then have an awareness of racism, of systemic oppression, and try to help things be better for the next generation? How do we educate ourselves about financial literacy and storing things up and getting educated and, you know, going to college and doing tons of things so we can make things better for our children and put them in positions to do better so that Black people as a race are thriving with the passing of each generation? And during 2020, there was this like image that kind of came off on and was posted all over social media where it was talking about like how our starting place is drastically different than other people of other races. And people will say, go forward. But our path, there's tons of obstacles and so many different things. And they're like, you could just go, like run your race. And you see this two different images that look totally different. And, you know, somebody who's of the majority race, white people, their path a lot of times looking different, but they're telling us that we're at the same starting point, and that's not true. So we have to acknowledge that. And we're talking generally. Of course, there's white people who have been impoverished, who have been, you know, who have had it much worse than a lot of Black people, like but we're talking broad generalizations, right? And broadly speaking, the starting point is not the same. So we have to acknowledge that. And then I have to say, come here, child, you know, so to speak, and let's look at what's in your hands. How do we help you to get from where you are to where you want to be? Because what we can't do is talk forever about how things are so crappy and so bad and there's no movement forward. We can't stay in that space forever.
Okay, Rob. Good question. Okay, so I think we're going to end it here. Ms. Beard, do you want to leave us with something this evening?
What would be the final kind of takeaway here?
Any parting words?
Parting words is racism definitely exists. It may not be as blatant. It definitely is institutionalized, and there are systems and programs designed, and you look at design theory and those kinds of things, and you see how things are designed without including certain groups. That's why there's a major push for diversity, equity, for inclusion, and all these kinds of programs emerging, because there are people who are not given privilege and people who are marginalized, and these are people of color. So we have to acknowledge that. We have to look at America and the brokenness of this country. And of course, there's many, I mean, with everything, there's many benefits and those kinds of things. If we compare our first world country to other countries, of course, there's many benefits. But we also have to look at some of the deficits in character, the deficits that have shown up in the character of people who were in positions of power, abusing their power, raping people, making people feel ashamed and taking away their dignity and those kinds of things. We have to acknowledge that and then look at processing through that trauma, however it's showing up in our lives today. And we have to do that processing. Ultimately, and I'm always going to advocate for this, you guys can turn me off if you don't agree, but ultimately, in a therapeutic context, we have to process trauma, whether it's race related or not, to be a better version of ourselves, because we're looking at that outside perspective. And ultimately, we will look up and we will be better people who treat each other kindly. And there's 13 grand challenges for the field of social work. One of them does have a lot to do with eliminating racism. So that's something that has been identified by the American School of Social Work as something that needs to change in this society. Oddly enough, when they first came up with the grand challenges of social work, that challenge was not mentioned. It was not identified as a challenge. There was other challenges: build healthy relationships to end violence. Okay, of course, you could say that violence, you know, is related to relationships and racism and those kinds of things. But specifically, eliminate racism was not one of the initial grand challenges of social work. And then that was updated, I want to say, a couple of years ago. So it's something that's on our radar as a profession. It wasn't initially verbatim and said specifically, but people are looking at it as a challenge in and of itself. And there are people that are in school right now working hard to develop innovative solutions to really tackle this problem in our society. I'm going to school with them. Beautiful minds, people from all over this country trying to really look at this problem because it needs to be addressed.
Yes, and I agree, needs to be eliminated. Yes, elimination of racism, white supremacy. And we are a part of that change agent, this community education network. We are a part of that. So I'd like to thank you for this wonderful presentation, interview, discussion. And you do have that nice demeanor for a therapist. I think demeanor has a lot to do with it also. You know, how you know, I got to work on my demeanor because I'm tough. But yeah, it was excellent. Excellent. I appreciate it.
And I appreciate you guys and your questions.
Okay. When we go offline, I need to ask you one thing. So don't leave right away.
Okay.
So I appreciate everybody that came this evening, Brother Damien, Professor Ra, Brother Mashinda, thanks a lot. Excellent topic, excellent interview, discussion. I'm just in awe of everybody. So next week, we have, let me pull it up here for myself. Next week we have, hey, it's our second year anniversary. We've been doing this for 2 years. So we got one of our good buddies coming on, educator Ronnie Roberts. And we're going to have our little celebration here, being on 2 years, and we're going to keep doing it until we can't do it. And matter of fact, we want to pass it on to somebody when we leave. So excellent, excellent. Professor Ra, anybody for Monday? Did you get a chance to talk to
Dr. Damon, Charles? No, Damon dealing with the Crenshaw Subway Coalition. He's supposed to call me back, checking his schedule. So I'll call you in the morning.
Okay, excellent, excellent. All right, everyone. Each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Everybody, right, have a good evening.
Tutanana.
Tutanana. See you.